In the last session, we were looking at the Chinnamatra view, and we had a look at some of the reasonings they use to refute that there is an external independent world. And we did a little bit of a meditation related to that in the last session. But of course, when we come to Prasangika, they would be a little bit critical of the Chittamatrans. They say, yes, it's good that you put a lot of effort into investigating a supposed independent external world and coming to realize there's no independent external world. But they would say that you haven't really applied the same type of analysis and reasoning to the mind itself. They would say that's what's lacking. So that's what I'd like to do now is a little bit of a meditation, turning attention to the mind itself, the so-called observer of these experiences, and see what we find. So let's do that meditation, and then we'll go back into the text. So setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And again, allowing the eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And bring your attention to your own mind. Observe your own mind and whatever is arising in the mind. without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of thoughts. Simply observing them as they arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. Now, do you have a sense of being the observer or witness, the one who is looking at the mind and all the thoughts arising in the mind? Do you have this experience? If so, what are the characteristics of the observer or witness? Are you the same as the mind that you are observing? If you are the same as the mind that is being observed, then is the mind simply watching itself? And if you are different from the mind that's being observed, then are there two minds? The one that is observing and the one that's being observed? And where is the observer located? Are you somewhere inside the head? Is the observer located outside the body? Is there in fact somewhere where the observer is not located? How big is the observer? Does the observer have a center? Does the observer have a physical limit or boundary? Is there in fact anything outside the observer? Now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest, resting in awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. simply resting in the stillness of awareness. So let's go back into the text. So we're in page 14 in the middle. So let's just review the last thing we covered in the last session. And we were talking about ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is that which is realized by a valid perception, directly realizing it by way of a vanishing of dualistic appearance. So here, of course, we're talking about this realization of emptiness according to Chittamatra. We're talking about now there appears to be this dualistic appearance. There appears to be an inner consciousness and an outer external world. And when we investigate that world, we'll come to realize that there is no external physical world. So there'll be a vanishing of this dualistic appearance, of this subject-object duality. So for them, this is emptiness. And here we have that described in two ways, that the subtle selfness as a phenomena is emptiness, that is the form and valid cognition, apprehending that form being empty of being different substances. Again, realizing that there's not two different substances, there's not an inner consciousness and an outer physical world, that they're not different substances. And thereby that realization of non-duality is this vanishing of that dualistic appearance. And as we saw in the text, actually, another way of describing this from a different perspective is the emptiness that is the form being empty of existing by way of its own characteristics as a basis for applying the term form. So again, just to recap what that means and how that relates to the first one, we can read a little bit from the book here. It's on page 186. He says the following. Because an awareness that knows a bulbous object is called pot does not exist prior to learning the name pot, that name pot exists in the nature of that bulbous object is that the name pot exists in that the nature of that bulbous object is contradictory. And the commentary for that is, regarding the mode of proving selflessness, if a bulbous thing were established by way of its own mode of subsistence as a basis for the convention pot, it would necessarily not depend on linguistic instruction. Therefore, because the awareness that it is called pot does not exist prior to designating it, i.e. learning the name pot, that the name exists independently of the nature of that object is contradictory. So this is what is that these objects do not exist by way of their own characteristics as a basis for applying that label or term. The fact that that actually implies the same as there's no external objects or they're not different substantial entities, there's another section in the text here which talks about that on page 191. And I read this out already, so let's go through it again. It says, in the general refutation of external objects, it says, since objects are not by their own nature established as reference for conceptual consciousnesses, their appearance as that to non-conceptual consciousnesses is mistaken, whereby is refuted that those objects and consciousness are different substantial entities. So the commentary says, when those objects, i.e. all phenomena, are seen as being without their own measure of subsistence, as being the reference of conceptual consciousness, then through knowing that even to a non-conceptual sense consciousnesses, there are appearances of objects as existing by way of their own nature as reference for conceptual consciousness, one understands that those appearances are false. Thereby, it comes to be refuted that the two, those consciousnesses and those objects, are different substantial entities. So, again, to realize that objects are not existing by way of its own their own nature as reference for the terms that are applied, we can understand that thereby they're not external objects. Because if they were external objects, as the lower schools implicate, they say, they would be a natural basis for applying the term. So these two things mean the same thing. And then the last point there was, it says, an illustration of selflessness of persons is the emptiness that is a person being empty of being self-sufficient, substantially existent. So for Chittamatras, we see in this Course in Subtle Selflessness chart that they, like the lower schools, but also even the Svatantrikas, which we were coming up to, they all accept that if this subtle selfness as a person is this self of a person is grasping to self being self-sufficient, substantial existence. And if we can eliminate that, if we can realize that selfness as a person, we can achieve liberation, achieve nirvana. As we see with the Prasangikas, they also say that realizing the person being empty of self-sufficient, substantial self is selfness as a person, but it's actually a coarse idea, meaning that realizing this is not enough to achieve liberation, to achieve nirvana. So we'll look at the Prasangika's assertion later on that. And then the selfness as a phenomena as we just indicated. So for Chittamatrans then, as we're going to see a little bit later, the afflictive obscurations, like the lower schools, is this conception of self-sufficient self. We eliminate that, we achieve nirvana. And now they posit the cognitive obscurations. What's stopping us from moving from nirvana to enlightenment is this grasping to self or phenomena, grasping onto phenomena being external to the mind. So if we can realize lack of subject-object duality, there is no external reality, that's the cognitive, we can overcome the cognitive obscurations and achieve enlightenment. But more about that will come later. So let's now look to the conventional truth. Sure.
It seems to me that their view of emptiness is really quite different to the Prasangika view of emptiness, in that they're saying the emptiness that's to be realized is the
lack of subject-object duality.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yes and no. Yes and no. Yeah. Yes and no. They're the same in that they're both refuting what we looked at, the Vaibhashika Satrantikas. Vaibhashika Satrantikas say there is a truly existent external world. So both the emptiness in Chittamatra and the emptiness in Prasangika refute that. But the Chittamatrans, in refuting that, say that it's an internal world. It's not external. Because the Chittamatrans, like the lower schools, for something to exist, it must truly exist. For it to work, it must truly exist. Therefore, it must be internal to the mind. Whereas Prasangika disagree. They say, yes, we refute external independent world, but that world is an external, dependent world. So, therefore, emptiness in Prasangika is really talking about all phenomena, not just the world, but the consciousness, the person, not existing from its own side at all. So, yes, in that sense, they're very different, in that the Majjhimikas refute true existence, whereas the Chittamatrans don't. So in that sense, they're very different. They're similar in the sense they're both refuting a world as existing as it appears.
Yes, but the Chittamatrans, there is actually no true existence.
there's no truly existent external world. There is true existence.
But it is internal. Yes. It is truly existent, but internal. It is internal. I see.
Correct. So they're both refuting that the world exists as it appears. Both refute that, but in a different way.
How do the Chief Martians explain then the non-existent external reality, the ability to affect consciousness, i.e. you get run over by a truck?
So they're not what's called what's the word? I'm trying to think. I can't remember the word now. They're not. See, what we need to understand is they're not negating functionality. So none of the Buddhist philosophical systems negate functioning world. Yeah. So remember the two extremes. So that would go to the extreme of nihilism for any school. So all schools accept the functioning world. There is a functioning world. So they're not negating that. And they would say that, you know, even in a dream where there is no external world, it still has efficacy, doesn't it, in a dream?
Yeah.
In the dream, you can feel pain and happiness and so forth.
Yeah.
Of course, they're not saying it's the same as the waking world, but they're saying it's similar in that even in a dream there's causal efficacy in that fact that in a dream, you know, something can happen and you can experience pain or fear or whatever. So just because it's not an external material world is not negating efficacy.
Okay.
It's not negating that it's functioning and it has causal efficacy. Because all Buddhist schools accept that. Otherwise, of course, the dropping to the extreme of nihilism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing we actually experience, the appearance that it actually, we don't actually ever experience the cup.
So remember, with Chittamatra and Majjhimika, there is no independent objective world, meaning, in fact, this is one of the reasons or one of the things they refute the lower schools, and it's actually common sense. And that's what we did in the last session, the meditation. The only world we experience is the world that appears to us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, a world independent of appearances is, in theory, unknowable. It's, in fact, unknowable. Because you can only know something that appears to you.
That's what neuroscientists are saying, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think...
We know what our brain processes in a way, that we experience what...
Yeah, yes, but I think they wouldn't draw the same conclusions as the Prasangika, for example. I don't think so.
No.
That sort of thing, you know, in neuroscience is helpful because it's moving in a direction that's more in line with this view, exactly that point. You know, this idea, you know, what's called naive realism, which no, I think, scientists would accept anymore, that the fact that we actually experience the world independent of our perceptions, I think no one in the neuroscientific world accepts that anymore. It's only what we, in our world of experience, that we actually contact. And of course, the Prasangikas draw a very subtle conclusion from that observation. Whereas for the Chittamatrans, and even certainly the lower schools, there's not that implication there based on that line of thinking. So for them, it still can be an independent, truly existent world, even though the Chittamatrans say the world is not existing as it appears. They don't see any contradiction there. Of course, Prasangikas would say, come on, what you're saying is contradictory.
So there's some kind of model of perception where if you look at the cup, the engaged object and the appearing object are the same, which is the cup. Can you take that to mind only that, you know, the engaged object is not knowable and all you have is the appearing?
But remember, again, we talked about this true aspectarian, false aspectarian. We can talk about appearance being non-deceptive in a certain way and deceptive in a certain way. So remember, the Chittamatrans are saying the appearances are deceptive in terms of being external. They're not saying the appearances are being deceptive in terms of the object existing truly, having true existence in terms of existing from its own side. So they're not saying that there's that. Of course, the Prasangikas would say, come on, this, what you're saying is a bit illogical, actually. So, of course, there'd be a lot of discussion there. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to conventional truth. It says that which is realized by a valid perception, directly realizing it by way of being together with dualistic appearance. So here we're talking about two types of conventional truth, and now we're coming back to these three natures that we originally mentioned in the beginning of today. So there are other power phenomena and compounded other power phenomena and conventional truths that are included in imputational constructs. Okay. So other power phenomena and compounded phenomena are equivalent. Compounded phenomena, of course, impermanent phenomena or functioning things. So as we saw then, other power phenomena or dependent phenomena, again, things that are produced through causes and conditions. That's why they're called other-powered, because they're produced through causes and conditions. And then we have imputational constructs. So this is, as they're saying, is imputational construct is the fact that we give this label or term cup to this object. So the object that we experience here, of course, other-powered, depending on cause and conditions, and then we impute cup on that. So that's okay. And it says here, conventional truths that are included in imputational constructs and uncompounded phenomena other than conventional ultimate truths are equivalent. Because remember, emptiness is an uncompounded phenomena. So therefore, not all uncompounded phenomena are imputational constructs or that are conventional truths, rather, because emptiness is an ultimate truth. So therefore, we have these three natures, and we can apply those to all phenomena. Is that the conventional truth, the phenomena we experience, the impermanent phenomena, are the other powered natures or other powered phenomena. And then on that basis, we impute or give names to these functional phenomena, and that's the imputed nature here that's part of conventional truth. So that's the existent imputed nature. But also what we wrongly do is we impute that this is an external cup. So that is a non-existent imputed nature, because they are saying that imputation that of it being an external cup is false. And so that's what they're saying emptiness is, or the thoroughly established nature, or the ultimate nature, is that emptiness is the lack of this imputed nature in the other-powered phenomena. So this cup is empty of being an external cup, is another way of saying that. So to go a little bit more on these three natures, we can go on to the next page, on page 15, to understand them a little bit more. All things, so here we see the word thing, which is functioning thing, which is another word for this other-powered phenomenon, other-powered nature. So all things are asserted to be the common locus of being truly existent and being a falsity. So what does that mean? So here, being truly, because we have two, there's later we'll see that something's falsely existent. So truly existent here means not something merely labeled by conception. They exist from their own side. So that's what truly existent means. And being a falsity here is the fact that this phenomena appears to exist externally. So its way of appearing as an external object and the way it actually exists doesn't match. So it's a falsity. So even though it truly exists, i.e. it exists from its own side without being merely imputed for the Chittamatrams, it's falsity because it's not existing as it appears. It appears to be external and it doesn't exist in that way. And then it says, all final realities, which of course is emptiness, are asserted to be a common locus of being truly existent. So emptiness is also not something, itself is not something merely imputed. It does truly exist. It exists in the way it appears. And it's also being true in that sense, that it does exist in the way it appears. Whereas the third category, or the imputed or imputational construct, which is next, it says all uncompounded phenomena other than final realities. So all uncompounded phenomena other than final realities is talking about this imputed nature, the imputational constructs, of course, are falsely existent because they are merely labelled by conception and they're false, meaning they do not exist as they appear. So that's how they've used these two words, truly existent or falsely existent, and being a falsity or being true. So, therefore, other power phenomena are truly existent, but they're false in that they appear to exist externally and they're not. Imputed natures, of course, are falsely existent because they do not exist from their own side. They're merely imputed by conception. And they are false because they also are not existing as they appear. Whereas emptiness is both truly existent and true. So that's what's being said in this paragraph here. Yeah, so that's what it says here. It says all final realities, the final reality is how things exist is emptiness, are asserted to be the common locus of being truly existent and being true. Final realities, or in other words, emptinesses, are necessarily non-affirming negative. So we saw that earlier. A non-affirming negative is a simple negation. It's not affirming anything else. So here, these emptinesses that we're talking about are simply negations, negating external reality, negating that things are naturally the basis for the labels that we apply to them. And it says, illustrations of other non-affirming negatives are similar to those of proponents of Sautrantika. So some of the other non-affirming negatives were, uncompounded space and true cessations and so forth. So a similar idea. Okay, now we get to an interesting point which is helpful in terms of understanding a little bit the idea of karmic imprints. The five sense objects, forms and so forth, are produced on the basis of a substance that is an inner consciousness in dependence upon the latencies of common and uncommon actions deposited upon the mind basis of all. They are not established as external objects. So what does that mean? Yeah, so what it's saying is that in the lower schools, and actually similar in the Prasangika, is that for an appearance or for apprehending some sort of form, let's say the flowers, we have an objective condition, the object, which then is an objective condition with the empowering condition and immediately preceding condition for consciousness to arise that apprehends the object. So we have this causal relationship in terms of the object producing the consciousness observing the object. And of course, for the Sautrantika Vaibhashika, that object is necessarily independent of the mind. In Prasangika, even though it's causal, it's not independent. So even Prasangika say that, even though Prasangika say that the flower is external to the mind, that doesn't somehow imply it's independent of the mind. So we need to keep that in mind. So there is this causal relationship between that object and then the mind, the consciousness that is produced that observes the object. Whereas here, since the object is not, for Chittamatrans, is not external to the mind, we don't have that causal process. In fact, they said that there is, it's dependent on a latency. So here is like another word for karmic imprint. So we have a karmic imprint. And remember, it says it's deposited upon the mind basis of all. So here, for the Chittamatrans, and actually this is only for the Chittamatrans following scripture, the ones who follow a Sangha, is they say that the illustration of the person is this mind basis of all. Because this mind basis of all, this eighth consciousness that we talked about briefly, is presented as being the place, the thing that sort of carries these imprints, this mind basis of all. And so we have these imprints on the mind basis of all, and these imprints are ripening. So, of course, in all Buddhist schools, we talk about karma and its result, you know, that we do an action and the result is our experiences. So we have the similar idea across all Buddhist systems. But in terms of how that mechanism works is a little bit different from system to system. So, of course, for the lower schools, they would talk about these karmic imprints. And I think also in Vaibhashika, from my memory, when we talk about these karmic imprints, they describe them in a very strange way as well, how they, the mechanism. But they have the same idea that you do an action, you have an experience as a result. And when we come into Prasangika, as we're going to see, they don't even use the concept of karmic imprints, which we're talking about here, these latencies. What's the expression they use here? Where is it? Latencies of common and uncommon actions deposit upon the mind base of all. So basically, the latencies of common and uncommon actions is another word for karmic imprints. So in Prasangika, we don't really have that idea of karmic imprints. Of course, in Prasangika, we do an action, there's a result. Same idea. But the mechanism, how that's described, is very different. And we're going to briefly touch on that in the Prasangika. So there's no real mention about karmic imprints as there is here and in the lower schools, and also in the Svatantrika. In the Chinnamatra, these karmic imprints are associated with the mind basis of all, this eighth consciousness. And this karmic imprints, as it says the five sense objects are produced on the basis of a substance that is an inner consciousness, independence upon... They are not established as external objects. So this karmic imprint then ripens... Here we're using the example of a pot or a cup. Let's use the example of a cup. So this karmic imprint ripens simultaneously as the observer and the object, subject-object. So this ripens simultaneously. So then we have an appearance of the subject, an appearance of the object arising simultaneously on the basis of this one imprint. And that's, remember, we talked about the example of one of the reasonings they use for refuting external objects is that we have those three different beings, the preta being, the deva being, and the human, who are looking in the same place, and one is perceiving nectar, one is perceiving water, and one is perceiving sort of pus and blood. And this is the same idea, is that the world of our experience is produced internal to our mind. But the idea being is that since we're all humans, our imprints are very similar, meaning the fact that even though from their perspective the world that we experience is internal to our mind, because these imprints are similar, the worlds that we experience are overlapping enough so that we can see each other and communicate. So we're not saying that Chinnamatra is like solipsistic. You know, it's not like I'm the only thing that really exists in the world and you're all a figment of my imagination. They're not, say, suggesting that. But this is the mechanism that they are mentioning here. And so to understand that, we can talk about actually, in fact, we're talking about cups and pots. What do we mean by pot or cup or object? So there's a little presentation on that in here, which I was going to bring up later, but I think it's a good time to bring it in here on the basis of what we've seen here. And this is in this book on page 415. And it's actually in the context of a debate between true aspectarians and false aspectarians, but I think it gives some very good insight into this and how that compares to the other schools. It says, first we should understand the following. Let us illustrate this with respect to one base, a pot. All outsider, meaning non-Buddhist, and Buddhist proponents of tenets agree in asserting that a pot is a component's possessor that is the composite of many particles that are its parts. The many particles that are its parts are the components. The pot is a component's possessor. So the pot is a component possessor possessing parts. All Buddhist, non-Buddhists sort of agree on that. However, there are various modes of asserting with regard to identifying the component's possessor that is called pot. The Vaisheshikas and Nayakikas, so these are two non-Buddhist systems, assert that when the many particles that are parts of the pot conglomerate, initially the quality of possession that is a separate factuality from the particles is produced. So I think they're basically saying the pot is more than the sum of the parts. There's something extra, which no Buddhist school would accept. After that, the substance that is the component's possessor called pot, and that is a separate factuality, is produced. So they say that the pot is not merely the collection of the parts. These non-Buddhist schools would say actually there's something, when they come together, there's something extra happens. There's a thing called a pot that is sort of, using the language, it's more than the sum of the parts. No Buddhist school would accept that. The two Hira schools, that is, the Great Exposition and Sutra school, which we covered, seeing that reasoning damages the assertion of a substance that is a component's possessor, which is a separate factuality, assert that. So they reject that idea that the pot is something more than the sum of the parts. They say the mere collection of the many particles that are the parts of the pot is the pot. So the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, the pot is the collection of the parts. That's it. Since there is no components possessor that is not the collection, a pot impurely exists. Here comes the mind-only Chinnamatra. The proponents of Chittamatra assert that the collection of the parts of a pot is not the pot. The factor of appearance, that is an appearance as a pot due to the force of the activation of a predisposition, is the pot. I.e. this. Hence, a pot is established as a substantial entity of the mind. The Svatantrika, so we're now in Majjhimika, the Svatantrika school, the Salchantika, agrees with the Salchantika school, and then we have a yogic, the Yogacara Svatantrika, which agrees with the mind only. So both the Svatantrika Majjhimika system, the Salchantika agree with what we've just said, the lower schools, the pot is a collection of the pot, and the Yogacara Svatantrika, who are in line with mind only, assert this mind only view. Then it says the Prasangikas assert that a pot is merely imputed by terminology and conceptuality to the collection of the many particles that are the parts of the pot. So to recap, some non-Buddhist schools say the pot is something more than the collection. There's something extra happening. All Buddhists reject that. The Vaibhashika Sautrantika say the pot is simply the collection of the parts. Mind only says the pot is not the collection of the parts, because the pot is this factor of appearance that is generated through this imprint. The Prasangikas say the pot is not the collection of the parts. The pot is merely imputed depending on the collection of the parts. Oh, for the mind only? Okay, I'll give you the phrase again. 4:15. The factor of appearance, that is an appearance as a pot due to the force of an activation of a predisposition, which is an imprint, is the pot. So that factor of appearance that is generated from that imprint, that's the pot. Because for them to say the pot is the collection of the parts, I think would imply that it's material, external. So they can't accept that.
I'm having real difficulty trying, unless I'm putting it wrong, of seeing that whole little diagram is supposed to be truly existent.
This is truly existent and this is truly existent. Okay. Right. So here, this cup that we see, is that depending on the mind that is observing it to exist?
Yeah.
No. They're coming up together.
They're coming up together.
So they can't. This can't depend on this to exist. They both are coming from this. So they actually exist independently of each other. They exist truly. Yeah? Whereas for Prasangika, this consciousness is generated depending on the object. And the object doesn't exist independent of the consciousness.
Yeah.
But because they're arising simultaneously, then they can't, of course they can't depend on each other to exist. They are coming from the imprint. That's the difference. So that's why this truly exists and this truly exists. And we've run out of time. But I think that's a good spot to leave it at. We can think about pots tonight, according to Chittamatra. We can dream about Chittamatra and pots tonight. Okay, so again, let's, before we run away, let's just spend a moment dedicating all of our efforts today, and we can do that in our own way. And then just after that, we'll read out the Shantideva dedication prayer, so it might be useful to have that handy. But first, just to spend a moment dedicating all the positive potential we've gathered here together today in our own way, based on our motivation from this morning. Let's read Shantideva prayer together. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you. Have a nice evening. See you tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. Finishing off Chittamatra, and then we'll move on to the Madhyamika systems.